Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Breakup Whisperer. I am your host, Batabi Libntumpany, The Breakup Whisperer, and I'm coming to you live from the southern tier of New York State in the United States of America. Breaking up with someone else can be challenging enough, but what about when you are challenged with breaking up with an unhealthy relationship with yourself? Today, my guest is Emmerina Wade, a talented actress and outspoken survivor of sexual violence. She is a victim advocate, and we'll be talking about the emotional impact of surviving sexual violence and the process Emmerina has followed to release herself from the burden of emotional trauma. Our topic today addresses sexual violence and might be triggering to some listeners. Our music is brought to us by the wonderful people at Purple Planet Music, www.purple-planet.com. Sit back and listen while everyone gathers. We'll be with you in just a moment. I am so happy that you are joining us on what is for me and my guest a very warm Sunday afternoon. It looks like summer is deciding finally to join us. So I'm up here in my studio. I have the air conditioner turned off for the duration of the show, and I'm drinking hot tea, believe it or not. Although I hear that this is a good technique for cooling down. People drink hot tea on hot afternoons. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but we're going to see how things go for the duration of the show. I am happy to welcome today Emmerina Wade to the show. She is my hero, and she's going to be kind of blushing and so forth to hear this. But I've told her that she's my hero, and she's far braver than I have ever been. And you're going to find out why as you listen into the show. We have a particularly sensitive topic today. This show I've rated PG-13 so that we are able to be a little bit more specific about the topic that we're going to be talking about, which is about sexual violence, sexual assault. And so I want to let folks know that for some listeners, this might be really troubling, difficult to listen to, but I encourage you to listen because the point of this topic and having this show is to help folks to be able to gather to themselves resources that can help them to work through the trauma, the pain, all of the difficult things that come along with surviving sexual assault. So I am happy to welcome, without further ado, Emmerina. Your mic is on. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. I hope that you're in a cooler situation than I'm in.
I was listening to your intro. I'm actually in the same boat, but I am drinking cold water and some warm coffee. I've heard that the warm drink thing is a myth, but you'll have to tell me.
Really?
I'm mixing and matching. Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah. You need to
cool
your core. So,
yeah. I'm drinking the hot tea for my voice. It's voice tamer, it's this lemon based tea that I like to sip on while I'm doing the show. So we'll survive. It's all right. We'll do okay.
Yeah. This show is about surviving, and we are going to survive making this show in moderate heat.
Absolutely. And I am so happy and honored to have you on the show. I met you through a mutual friend of ours, actually, but then got to know you a little bit better after we became friends on Facebook. And I saw that you were acting. You were in a couple of shows, and I had the pleasure of seeing one of them. So one of the things that you do is act. You're a working actress.
Yep.
And then also, you are a victim advocate. And I'm very happy that you're here to talk a bit about what that is and about what inspired you to become a victim advocate. But I want to dive right in and talk about victim advocacy, especially in the context of survivors of sexual assault, what it is that you do, and then we can talk a bit about how it is that you came to be doing what you're doing.
Okay. So I currently work as a legal advocate for a nonprofit here in the Southern Tier area. Before I was a legal advocate, I was a community educator for the same nonprofit. As a community educator, I went to schools. I talked to primarily elementary school students through high school students in age-appropriate ways about topics like boundaries. You know, for children, we sort of talked in an age-appropriate way about childhood sexual abuse and you know, some ways to set boundaries and some ways to feel more comfortable letting someone know if something was happening to them that didn't seem quite right. And we talked to middle schoolers and high schoolers about sexual consent and about dating violence. And I really enjoyed that. I did that part-time while I was working on my bachelor's degree. And then when I graduated, I switched departments and now I work full-time as a legal advocate. So I help victims of crime navigate the legal system and the criminal justice system, at which there's a million facets to that. It's the criminal justice system is pretty complicated. So anything from helping them find the right paperwork and get it filled out. Sometimes just explaining the process as I accompany victims to court. I meet with victims if they are reporting a crime to law enforcement or if they're talking to a prosecutor. I go to those meetings with them. So I call myself an emotional caddy sometimes. I'm just sort of their personal assistant on a really rough day. And, you know, I just sort of help bridge the gap and help make sure that their questions are being answered and doing any follow-up that needs to be done.
Well, you're doing good work, and I have a little bit of experience with that myself. I volunteered during my first year in law school for an organization that helped women to get temporary restraining orders and orders of protection. Mm-hmm. And so we did a similar thing, you know, went to court with them, and it's extraordinary how vulnerable and helpless one can feel when one is not only dealing with the reality of having been violated, but then going through a system that can add to the violation, unfortunately, even if it's not the intent, just the nature of the beast, you know, it lends itself to that kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's something in our criminal justice system that I think is beautiful, and it's that the whole idea of being innocent until you're proven guilty is one. So most of the rights in a criminal justice system are given to the defendant or the alleged perpetrator, and victims don't have nearly as many rights, and you know their well-being is not considered as important. And the other thing is that in you know the American criminal justice system, it's not victim versus abuser; it's abuser versus the people. And I think that that is a beautiful concept in that, you know, you didn't just hurt this one person. You hurt all of us. We all agreed that we don't, you know, do these violent acts to each other. And in so doing, you have hurt the entire community. I think that that's a beautiful concept. It makes a victim just a witness to a crime that happened. And they're not really represented, you know, but the way I explain it to victims when they ask, do I have an attorney? I explain, well, no. The attorney is representing all the people, and you're one of those people, and, you know, some of your tax dollars are going to them, but, you know, you're not personally represented in this. You're just a witness to the crime. I mean, you know, I don't word it that way necessarily, but it really leaves victims out of the equation a little bit, and that can be really invalidating.
Well, yes, and I can imagine it could be a little bit confusing as well, because I think our popular culture leads us to believe in this, you know, sense that a person will go through a trial and come out feeling vindicated. know, that they'll personally feel vindicated, and then to come, and that could happen. You know, we'll talk a little bit about the legal case that you were involved in, and how you feel in the aftermath. But there's, you know, there's a potential for that. But still, when the caption of the case is the state of New York versus so-and-so, and, you know, I'm the one who was hurt. You know, this person did this to me, but I'm now merely a witness. You know, that can feel invalidating, I would think, to some extent.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly every victim reacts differently and has a different opinion about it. But, yeah, for some people, it's really tough.
Right. Well, so this is something with which you are intimately familiar, and I would like to talk a bit about why that is and how you came to be a victim advocate. So if you wouldn't mind going back 12 years and telling us the story of what has transpired to, I think if there's anything that can substantially change somebody's life and alter the direction of their life, it would be this. So please tell us what happened.
Okay. So it was, I'm actually right now wondering, I don't have the date memorized, but I'm wondering if today might be the anniversary. It was in June of, I don't know the year either. I actually once heard somebody say, you can tell how much someone has recovered from a traumatic event by if they say, oh, this thing happened 12 years ago, or if they say this thing happened on this date at this time. So maybe it's a good thing I don't remember the exact date, but 12 years ago this month, I was a working actor in Virginia Beach. And I'm going to kind of start from a little bit before the incident happened. I was a working actor in Virginia Beach. I was doing stand-up comedy. I had gotten my first four-figure paying gig that day. I had gotten some, some training film for the Navy. And I was very happy. So I was celebrating. I worked at a comedy club. I had a few jobs, but that night I was working at a comedy club. So I had a few drinks, and I had a roommate who had an infant. So at that time in my life, I was using drugs. I was smoking pot and things, and I'll talk more about that in my story. But so I wanted to go someplace to celebrate, and I wanted to, smoke some of the marijuana. I think that's how the kids say it. So I wanted to go someplace. I wanted to go someplace, not at my apartment because there was a child there, but someplace, frankly, where there weren't going to be law enforcement, and there was this area of the north end of the beach that was pretty secluded. I went there. I was on the phone with someone. So I think I was a little distracted from the fact that I was going to a secluded area by myself. I went to the secluded area. I did what I had gone there to do. I got off the phone and I was just enjoying the beauty of this night. And an important part of the story is that up until this point, I was really afraid of the dark and really afraid of water I couldn't see through. But it was just a gorgeous, beautiful night. The weather was perfect. The sky was just full of stars. And I decided to go swimming. So I went skinny dipping. And while I was in the water, I had this profound existential moment staring up at the stars and realizing I didn't have to be afraid of the dark or of the water. And I could have these beautiful life experiences if I just went through my fear. And then as some time passed and I came out of the water and I saw a man standing there. My first thought was that he was walking a dog, and I was embarrassed. And so I started to go back into the water to cover myself. And then I realized he didn't have a dog. And I also realized I could see his torso and his chest. And I realized that I was now alone on a beach with a man who wasn't walking a dog, who was naked, and I was naked. And the word duh, I heard the word duh in my head. Which I'll talk more about the significance of that. But, I heard the word duh. Like, of course this is happening to you. You just every safety tip for ladies, you know, so that we don't get raped. You did every single one of those things tonight. And then some new ones that nobody even thought of, that, you know, you know, it was like 3 a.m. or something like that. The bars had closed,
oh,
you know,
boy.
So I thought, duh. And I offered him money and he just shushed me and he laid me down on the sand and waves started crashing over my face and he held me down with the water over top of me. And so, of course, I struggled involuntarily because that, you know, I'm a human and we need oxygen. And so I struggled and realized that I was zero match for him physically at that moment. So when the waves went back out, that's, you know, I was in just total survival mode and just said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Please just take me out of the water. So he did. He took me out of the water. There was the next step, and I'm going to get into some details. This is the first time I've spoken about this since the trial. And so it's the first time I'm able to really get into the details of what happened. And I'm going to choose to do that. So my next thought when he pulled me out of the water was I was menstruating and I actually had a tampon in. And it was very clear what was going to happen. He was naked. He was shushing me when he laid me down. He was kissing my breast. And I remember the dissonance of that moment because, you know, kissing a breast is such a loving, intimate act. And this was not a loving, intimate thing. You know, this was violence. There was no way I could talk my way out of this situation, which was very foreign to me. But it was almost like dealing with an animal, like a dog. There was nothing I could say that was going to rationalize or change the situation. So it was clear that it was sexual. And I just thought, well, this isn't going to be good if I get raped with a tampon in. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's not going to be good. So I told him, you know, I have a tampon in, can I please remove that? I think because of that request, he ended up just forcing me to perform fellatio. And I'm not sure how long it lasted, but when it was done, he ejaculated on me. And then my first words when it was over were, can I please go home now? And I chose those words very specifically because I through all of this, specifically after he held me under the water, through all of this, I was pretty sure he was going to murder me when he was done. I kept imagining a rock. So I said, can I please go home now, in the hopes that he would think I wasn't going to report it. Because I certainly thought if he had any idea I was going to report it, then he would have, you know, killed me somehow, drowned me, beat me in the head, who knows. That would be the end of it. So it was really amazing to me how well you can survive in a situation like that. I'd had some drinks. I had, you know, smoked some pot. But all the decisions that I made while the assault were happening were really good decisions. So he ran away after I said that. I kind of went around the beach looking for my clothes. I found them. And then I just said I was going to go to a police station, but I was speeding, hoping that if there was an officer on the side of the road that I didn't see, that they would see me. And I did find some officers on the side of the road. I was a smoker at the time. And the one thing I remember is that we had to wait, I want to say about an hour, hour and a half, for a forensic officer to come and collect the semen. So I waited on the side of the road for that amount of time with a stranger's semen all over my face and neck.
Oh, God.
And I couldn't smoke a cigarette because the cigarette smoke could damage the DNA.
Yeah.
So we kind of went through this loop of me repeatedly asking if I could smoke a cigarette and the officers telling me no, and then I would cry. And then a little while later, I would ask again, can I please smoke a cigarette? And they would say no, and then I would cry. But yeah, waiting there for that amount of time with the semen on my face and not being able to touch it or wash it off was, yeah, that was quite an experience. And then, so moving forward past the assault, there was an investigation. The very next thing that happened was I went home. By that point, it was around 5:30 in the morning, and I called my mom. I called my mother partially because, you know, I was privileged enough to have a mother who was supportive, and also because she was the only person I knew who would be awake at 5:30 in the morning. So I called my mom, and, you know, she's an ardent feminist. She is just very progressive, very smart. And still, the very first thing she said was, and I explained the situation. I said, Mom, I was alone at the beach skinny dipping and I got raped. And she said, I'm going to choose my words wisely. Why were you there? You know, even in her mind, knowing that that's not the most useful question to ask, it was still just the first thing we ask.
Yeah.
And then after that, everything she said was perfect. She explained to me that he had taken my power away, and that there were actions I could take to get my power back, and that I needed to tell everyone around me what had happened so that I wouldn't be alone and isolated with this. Which I did. I immediately told all of my coworkers. Also, part of the criminal investigation involved interviewing my coworkers at the comedy club, because part of my paranoia was that perhaps he had followed me from the comedy club. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was a big part of my fear. So one of the really magical things that happened is, as I told everyone, the percentage of women, and men, of course, are victims too, but...
All right, guys, we have a little bit of a technical problem, unfortunately, sometimes up here in the Southern Tier. We get calls drop out, unfortunately, and since most of us are on cell phones, that's going to happen. So I'm going to wait a moment to let Marina call back in while the... while she gets her phone back up. In the meanwhile, if you're listening, and I'm going to ask her when she comes back on whether she would be willing to take questions. But if you're listening live and you'd like to ask questions, the guest call-in number is 929-477-3697. That's 929-477-3697. And, of course, I'm going to ask Marina's permission. I've kind of, like, you know, put the horse before the cart. But I'm going to ask her permission and see if she's willing to talk with folks who want to call in. All right. So as we wait for Marina to call back in, I'm going to play a little bit of a clip for you that talks a bit about Untangled Resolutions and what we do and why we're doing it. And then we'll be back with you in just a moment. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Breakup Whisperer, a show dedicated to promoting healthy breakup culture. Untangled Resolutions' breakup coaching services can help you to figure out if you should break up, how to discuss breaking up, and how to nurture yourself after a breakup. Contact me, Batabile Mtombeni, The Breakup Whisperer, at welcome@123untangled.com. That's welcome@123untangled.com. Be sure to visit us on Facebook, like our page, and leave a note. Is there a topic you'd like us to cover? A guest you think would be great on the show? Please let us know. Facebook.com/123untangled. That's facebook.com/123untangled. And now, let's get back to the show. Well, folks, I'm back on the air, but we haven't been able to reach Marina yet. She's calling in just a moment. Hold on. Hello. Oh, don't worry about it. We have it covered. I'm still broadcasting. Go ahead and call right back in. All right. You got the number? No, you called my cell phone, which is fine. Bye-bye. Okay, so we are still on. Amarina will be calling back to the Blog Talk Radio number in just a moment, and we'll get her back on. But, you know, to sort of recap, one of the things that I'm most impressed by and just taken aback by is Amarina's presence of mind in finding the police right away. So many people are so in so much shock, and this isn't criticism. I mean, we each react to traumatic events differently, and we might react to each traumatic event differently. But what I'm really resonating with is Amarina's immediate thought and presence of mind, not only in terms of how she addressed the man who attacked her so that he did let her go, but that she immediately went and she found the police. And you're back on the air, Amarina. And we're at this point where... Hi.
So, how long was I gone? I said some really great stuff while I was off the air.
Oh, no. No. All right. Well, you're going to have to remember all of this great stuff.
Oh, geez. Where did you lose me? Where did I disappear?
You were talking about the police interviewing your coworkers at the Comedy Club. You were concerned that he had followed you from there. Yes, unfortunately.
Okay. And that's where we're now. Okay. No. So I'm on a cell phone. I'm one of those millennials who doesn't have
a landline.
He doesn't have a landline. Yeah. So I will.
That's all right.
I will listen closer. I thought while I was listening, I thought, man, she hasn't made any active listening sounds recently. But so I'll keep listening for those.
Well, and you know, for full transparency, because I know people want to get back to the story, but on my end as well, I was kicking myself because I decided to charge my cell phone right before the show started, about a half hour before the show started, but I forgot to unplug it and bring it to my desk. So it's on the other side of the room, right? So I can't grab my cell phone to contact you to let you know that you've dropped off the air. You know? So it was
funny.
This whole, if it could go wrong, it did. But this is cool. We're back. And yes,
we're
so
back.
Please share with us with the brilliance that we've missed out on.
Yes. So, well, I want to jump in and just address the one thing you had said about me going to the police right away. And then I'm going to jump back into the story. What's really different about this sexual assault and the typical sexual assault is that this was a stranger who jumped out of the bushes, you know, the proverbial bushes. So that is not how most sexual assault happens. I've actually been a victim of two other sexual assaults that I didn't report to the police because they were people I was dating. And that is when sexual assault usually happens. It's very hard to go to the police in those cases because we don't always call them sexual assault. We call them bad hookup, or we, we're afraid what's going to happen to my friend group. My parents are going to hate this person now. I don't want to ruin their lives. They're usually such a great guy. Well, I'm not going to say guy, but they're usually such a great person. I'm not going to ruin their lives over this one slip up. So the
entanglement is there. It's more complicated.
Right. And that's the much more typical sexual assault scenario. In mine, it was a no-brainer. There was a predator on the lurch, and I had nothing to lose by going to the police. I had nothing at all
to
lose.
Even though there was that issue of, you know, if there was a checklist that you could go down of things that you're not supposed to do. Even in that context, because this was a stranger, you did feel more comfortable going to the police directly about it.
Right. And there was, there was one moment at the side of the road that the officers, because I had been drinking, and the officers asked me if I was inebriated. And I think probably because I kept asking if I could smoke a cigarette and crying. and they asked if I was inebriated, and I just sort of looked at them in shock and said, "Are you going to give me a DUI right now?" and they didn't. And I think we were there long enough that, you know, my blood alcohol content, my BAC, you know, had gone down and they were comfortable letting me drive. But, yeah, there just were no social, there was nothing to lose socially.
Okay.
And that's why it was a no-brainer.
And I remember precisely.
No,
I wanted to say I remember precisely what you were saying, just to, you know, to let you know where you were when you dropped off. You were saying that so many of the women, in particular, with whom your coworkers, who are women whom you told about the assault, and I think you were going to say that they shared similar experiences. So that's where you were. But, yeah.
Yes. So my mother had encouraged me to tell everyone in my, you know, around me, and having them share those experiences and seeing that they got to the other side was huge. And actually, I'm glad the call got cut off, because that just sparked in me something I hadn't mentioned, which was, for me, it was about 5 days. It was the first 5 days to a week after the assault. The word I would use is crazy. That's pretty ableist, but it's the word that I used at the time to describe what that experience was like. There was one instance in particular. I was seeing a new person when it happened. I had just started seeing the bartender at the comedy club where I worked, and he was also the bouncer. And I don't think it was a coincidence that I started dating the biggest, strongest guy with access to alcohol that I could find as soon as this happened.
Okay.
But, you know, I would say it was a few weeks after the assault, as some random person I didn't know started chatting me up, and I went and called the police to come arrest this person, because I knew that this was the attacker and they were messing with me. And then in that process, I told somebody, and they said, no, that's your boyfriend's friend. He's just trying to get to know you. Mm-hmm. And so I had to call the police back and say, no, please don't come. But so it was that, please don't come, let's go. Geez, my new boyfriend's going to be very upset with me. But it was that constant vigilance and fear of everyone. And I can remember one time I had driven home. It was nighttime. There was about a median width stretch of trees. They were tall trees. I could see right through them to my front door. But I had to walk through this little stretch of trees, and I froze. I couldn't open my car door. Something about walking through this area, there's a word for it. It's called tonic immobility, but I physically froze and couldn't move. I couldn't get out of my car. And the next emotion I went to was rage, just pure rage that this was affecting me so much. And I started beating my dashboard and screaming and crying, and that was kind of par for the course the first week after it happened. Just no real control over my emotions. I felt filthy. I also had dreadlocks at the time, and they were covered in sand. You know, during the assault, he laid me on my back and forced me to do the fellatio while he was on top of my head. So there was a lot of sand in my hair, and, you know, you have dreadlocks, you know, it doesn't just, you just don't get things. I think it's in your dreadlocks. That thing permanently is in your dreadlocks.
It's there.
Yeah. So yeah, it's there. So there was also this sort of, this thing of the more sand that came out of my hair, the cleaner I felt. And but it took a long time to get that sand out of my hair. But so moving forward, sort of some ways that the system had some cracks in it. It was just a cold case, and nobody ever told me what had happened with that DNA that they collected from my face. And I know that they had, you know, they wouldn't let me smoke cigarettes because they had said the DNA was so fragile. So for all I knew, the DNA was completely illegible. And it was just a coincidence that I was on a community softball team with a woman who mentioned that she worked for some sort of forensic collection testing government agency. And, you know, because I'm outgoing and I'm, you know, pretty uninhibited, I was comfortable enough to ask this acquaintance if she would, you know, check into the database and see if she could get any information on my assault. And she was able to tell me that, yeah. And so she was able to tell me that it was legible, but it didn't have any matches to anybody in the system. But so that's just another example of it. And I can tell you, doing the work that I do, that job's not assigned to anybody. You know, it's there. Nobody has the job of calling a victim back and telling them what happened with the forensic evidence.
And you know,
that
that's so
that position. Right.
Right. Well, I just want to say that it's so important, you know, in the aftermath of any kind of trauma, you know, mystery is, we don't deal very well with mystery, with the unknown. It's, you know, one of the greatest sources of fear. You talk about, you know, things jumping out of the bushes. Well, the bushes, you know, in the dark, you know, there's a reason why human beings tend to be afraid of the dark. It's the things that you can't see, the things that you don't know, that allow space for the brain to go to the worst possible outcome. Right. And so in this situation, that's what were you left to assume until you had this woman go and in check? And like you're saying, there isn't anybody available to do that. Is that something that you're able to do as a legal advocate?
If somebody calls me and asks me to look into something like that, yes, I can. But it takes the victim or the family member of the victim making that call and asking. There's just logistically and realistically no way for prosecutors or law enforcement or the advocates to follow up on all of those details on 100% of the cases. There's just no way to do that. So it really takes, you know, and I had no idea that who I would even call to ask that question. And so it just so happened that this person was on the softball team. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. I will say that as a victim advocate, some of the happiest and phone calls I get and some of the warmest moments I have at work are when people call and ask just how the process works. And I might not even know any details about their case. I might not know anything like that. And just explaining the general process of the criminal justice system, and explaining the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, the worst case scenario and the best case scenario and what's most likely to happen. Even if I'm giving them bad news, just getting the information makes people feel better most of the time.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. So that happened, and then about 4 years after all of this happened, I had assumed it was a closed case and that, you know, I was never going to have this mystery solved. I got a call that, and this is in the paper, so I'm comfortable saying it, his wife had reason to suspect that he was committing sexual assault, and so she went to law enforcement. That was a long process for her. I don't know that she was readily believed. But eventually someone did believe her, and she provided some hair clippings from him, and they ran his DNA from those pieces of hair and opened 5 cold sexual assault cases. And based on what I know about sexual assault perpetrators, most men don't rape. I know I'm being gender normative, but I'm just going with the statistics. Most people don't rape. Let's say that. Most people don't rape. The ones who do rape a lot of people. And that is why we have such huge percentages of victims. So for him to have 5 cases that are known about, I'm going to guess, this is totally a guess, there are no facts here, I am not accusing this man of anything more than he's been convicted of, but I'm going to guess he probably has dozens or hundreds of victims.
That's just incredible.
But five of our cases were open. He actually, he's not from America originally. He fled back to his home country. And then because the sexual assaults had happened in multiple states, the FBI spent the next 4 years working on extraditing him from his home country. And then he came back, and then it was about 4 years of that, of going through the trials for the different victims. Only four of us were willing to testify at those trials. So after the four trials, he ultimately received two life sentences. For my assault, he received 40 years. And then for another assault, he received 20 to 25 years. And all of these will be served consecutively. So once he dies, he will then start his second life sentence. And then once he dies the second time, I'm being a little, I'm making light of a very serious situation.
Gallows humor, which is fine.
Yes.
Folks understand, I wanted to make sure that folks understand that there's a difference between serving a sentence consecutively and serving it concurrently. Consecutively is a harsher sentence, if you will, because it means, and it's all symbolic, really is. I mean, I don't know that we really have the power over a person's reincarnation, but, it is a harsher sentence, and it speaks to that. And I do want to also back up, to this reaction that I had about this woman coming forward to report her own husband and having to argue about it, having to insist, that she wasn't believed.
Yeah, that's something I see all the time. And I'm not going to speak specifically to their marriage because I don't know all the details, but I will say in general, as a victim advocate, what I see is that if there is a divorce going on or child custody or any other number of things, perhaps mental illness, perhaps drug addiction, and again, none of these are things that were necessarily present in this marriage. But anytime you have any of those things, it makes you, it makes a victim come off pretty incredible. And they're quickly not believed. And I see a lot of, as an advocate, I see a lot of allegations of abuse or something else chalked up to, well, they're just going through a divorce, or, this party is just upset that the relationship ended and they're trying to get back at them. And it's a big hurdle in the criminal justice system. And, perhaps it is true sometimes, but certainly not most of the time. I won't go into all that, but I will say in this case, it meant that for a couple years, five.
He was free to continue.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, listen, I want to make sure that we have adequate time to really get into the meat of why I asked you to do this show. The show is about breaking up with things that don't serve you. And so, in the aftermath, even though you had the classic, quote unquote, rail rape, there's a book by Susan Brown Miller, pretty well known, called Real Rape, and that talks about this. It began the conversation about, acquaintance rape, date rape, and how that was treated differently from, the man jumps out of the bushes, and that's considered legitimate rape. So, in this situation, you do have that, and yet still, I'm sure that there were personal, emotional challenges that you had to deal with, because we live in a culture that is so still, bent on placing blame on victims of sexual assault.
One of the biggest hurdles I had to get over very early on in crisis counseling was, how could anybody in their right mind say that this wasn't my fault? On high and drunk alone in a secluded area where I specifically went because there weren't going to be police there. And then naked in the middle of the night by myself, that's why my first thought was duh, because that's what happens. And a really important piece of information I got from a crisis counselor was that it doesn't matter if I was walking down the middle of Times Square at 4 a.m. wearing nothing but red high heels, no one has a right to lay a finger on somebody else without their consent. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of consensual sex. If you say, okay, I want this to stop now, then it needs to stop now. You know, there is never any scenario in the entire world in which it's okay for somebody to do something sexual to you without your consent, or, you know, to do any number of things without your consent.
And without affirmative consent.
Exactly. Without, yes, enthusiastic affirmative consent. So that was the first big hurdle, was sort of realizing that myself, that it was okay. And I think having gotten through that and having told everybody about it, you know, all taking all that advice my mother gave me to help get my power back, I think really helped me through those 12 years. I also was always let my partners know about it. The first time I had a consensual sexual experience after it happened was about a month later. You know, my partner he was a bartender at the comedy club where I was working, and he was on board. You know, he knew what I had been going through and what I had been dealing with, and we proceeded with caution. And I just kept sort of taking things back. Even the first time I masturbated after it happened, I was afraid that that was going to be traumatic. But I just kept slowly just taking things back, and sort of the first morning after it happened, I went back to the beach. I had lost my cell phone and the lighter, and I went back to the beach, and it was, you know, 85 degrees. And I went back with a long sleeve shirt and sweatpants because I was not going to be exposed to the world. And I wandered around the beach like a maniac, you know, everybody's out in their bathing suits. And I went back looking for something I had lost. And, you know, I was looking for the cell phone and the lighter, but I was looking for something else that I lost. Yeah. And I just slowly spent those first few weeks and months collecting those things I had lost. Fast forward 12 years, there was ups and downs as different. I eventually, you know, completely abstained from drugs and alcohol now, but there were different steps in the process where things would come up with the trial, or, you know, they would call and say, we figured out who it was, but he fled the country. And, you know, my drug abuse and alcohol use would spike around those times. And so again, it was, I went through the process of, hang on, I'm so sorry.
No worries.
I went through the process of stopping, you know, dealing with that, and realizing that I was just trying to mask symptoms of trauma. And that was another step in getting me back.
And what are those most symptoms that you're talking about specifically?
Well, so,
you know, because I'm imagining that there are people, there are tons of people who are listening,
right,
who are dealing with this themselves, and it helps to hear it from somebody else who have been through it, is going through it, and is managing it as bravely as you did. I mean, you know, nobody I know, I think I can say this with confidence, nobody I know had, you know, the first, they had that encouragement, that empowerment from somebody like your mother, who says, go and tell everybody. I mean, that's the exact opposite of convention.
Yep.
Like, nobody does that. And yet it was so very important to your healing process. So what were the, you know, consequences, the traumas that you were trying to mask, you know, with the drugs and the alcohol?
I mean, it was the hypervigilance. It was the fear. It was years before I went to a beach alone again. One really important distinction I want to make is I was never diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, but I still had a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms. And I'll talk, and they're in those are hypervigilance. My body believes I'm in danger, even though rationally I know I'm not. I had, situation come up recently where I joke around a lot at work, and I'm a kind of a prankster, and there's, you know, three or four other people that we all pull pranks on each other. And somebody kept tapping on my door knob, and I couldn't see who it was or catch them. They kept running away before I could catch them. But it made my stomach turn, and my eyes were watering, and I was saying to myself, this is one of your coworkers who you care about, and they care about you, and no one's trying to hurt you. But right. my body said, no, that someone's going to murder you. There's someone's trying to get in your office to murder you. And, you know, that's one of those symptoms I have, is that my body decides that I'm in danger and I can't convince it otherwise. Right. After all the trials ended, we had these trials in October. Well, my trial was in October. And then I testified at the sentencing for two other victims after my trial. And after that last door closed at the end of December, I'm sure there's a million reasons why, but my post-traumatic stress symptoms came back to the level they were that first week after the assault happened. And I started having daymares. And for any listeners who aren't familiar with what a daymare is, it's kind of like a hallucination. It's kind of like when you watch one of those TV shows like Ally McBeal or Scrubs, and something really outlandish happens, and then they cut back and you realize that it was just in their imagination, nothing outlandish happened. That's what a daymare is like. And so for a few weeks after all the trials ended, anytime I opened a door that I couldn't see to the other side of, or anytime I walked past a stranger and I was alone with that stranger that I was walking past, I would have a pretty vivid, I'm going to say hallucination, that might be a strong word for what it is, but I would have a hallucination of that person or of an imagined person strangling me to the wall or to the floor and punching me in the head until I died. And I would know that this wasn't happening. I could see the person standing there not doing this to me, or I could see the room I had just entered was empty. But as far as my body knew, this was happening. And so I would get the adrenaline and all of the different, you know, reactions that we get in a traumatic event. And I spent a lot of time crying in bathrooms, just trying to regain my composure. I had somebody, as will happen when you work in victim services, someone was explaining a traumatic event that had happened, and I just got very dizzy, and I had to have the other advocate handle the case. So these were the symptoms that came back, and I feel a little bad that I spent so long talking about the event and not more time talking about this. I have a really, really great therapist, and something that she reminded me at this time that was so important, was that my body had learned that the world is pretty dangerous. That, you know, I know what it's like to be among someone who could end your life. And I know that that's a fact. It's not just something in horror movies. It's a fact. People murder people. And my body keeps reminding me, like, don't forget that this thing happens. And that is a really awesome thing my body is doing to keep me alive. So when I have these reactions, I just kind of have a conversation with my body and I just say, I appreciate the information. I hear you. I believe you. And I'm grateful that you're reminding me. And that kind of helps. I do other mindfulness exercises, like I pay attention to the color of the wall in front of me and the sounds I can hear and, you know, any sensations on my body just to bring me back to my present moment. And in the worst case scenario, I had something come up recently. I was triggered by something at work, which happens from time to time. All of my coworkers and my supervisors are, you know, pretty understanding. And it's pretty natural in any human service field that most people are drawn to human services because of some experience. I think the statistic is 40%, but that seems low. So, you know, we all sort of look out for each other and we know what our triggers are. But I was triggered by something one day that made me think, well, he's out of jail and he knows what your name is because you said it in the paper and he's coming here to murder you now. He's on his way here to murder you. And I just could, I was started having daymares of just seeing him running towards me on the street. Said, well, body, I appreciate the message. But I'm going to, there's a website, you know, VineLink, that tells you who is incarcerated. And said, I'm going to check VineLink. And sure enough, look, he's still there. He's still in prison. So don't worry about it. And then my body said, well, you know that that's not right 100% of the time. He's on his way. He's coming here to kill you. And I wow. thought, well, shoot, I like, my tool didn't work. What am I going to do? And so I, you know, talked to my therapist about it. And the fact was, sometimes we just have to say, well, I might die today. I might die today, and that's okay. You know, if it's my time to go, it's my time to go, and there's nothing that can be done about it. It's really just continually regaining that power. Also trusting that when I have these experiences that they're going to pass. I can certainly say that they're fewer and farther between. Most of the height of this really bad trauma happened in December and early January. The third week of January, I went down to Washington, D.C. for the Women's March. I was in a huge crowd of people, and I felt completely safe, which was a pretty big miracle because, you know, a few weeks before, I didn't feel safe opening doors. And again, I think the thing that helped me through that the most was I had told people that I was having these experiences. I told people that I was having these daymares and these post-traumatic experiences, and I wasn't denying that they existed. I wasn't trying to just ignore them until they went away. I was accepting them and embracing them. And that had, for me, has really been how I'm able to let go of some of this stuff, is by not trying to let go, but by understanding, you know, it's there for a reason. And the other big thing of remembering is that it wasn't fair. It's not okay. There's, you know, that's something I hear from victims quite a bit. And it's also my own experience. You know, I had to use all of my sick time to go to these trials. And now, you know, sick time is a pretty big privilege. It's, you know, I'm privileged that I have sick time available for use. But part of me really resented that I had to use my sick time. And I thought that he should pull money out of his commissary to pay my wages, I guess. I don't know what I thought should happen. But
it's a thing. It's a thing, and it's a material thing, and it matters.
Right. Right.
You know, and for the people who don't have sick time, you know, it really matters.
Right. It does. It does. So, you know, maybe it's from a place of privilege and it's not necessarily useful for other people, but was just saying, yep, this sucks and this isn't fair, but this is what's happening. And that's, you know, a big part is acceptance, just not trying to fight what happened, but just accepting that it happened.
Right. And listen, in terms of the time, we are coming down to sort of the last minute and a half of the show that is scheduled.
Yeah.
But I have the suspicion that if we keep going, it's going to be okay. We'll continue to record. And so we'll be able to keep going, and we'll see what happens. But I do want to say, just in case, thank you so very much, because you have been able to wrap it up nicely. You know, several of the things that you have done that I think are especially helpful for people to know is that, first of all, you told everybody that you talked about it. You didn't try to suppress it or hide it. You know, that can make it into its own monster, that itself. You know, the other is what you came to understand about the physiology of your brain. And I do plan to have somebody on to speak specifically about the brain and fear and, you know, the amygdala and the function of the amygdala, and how it is that you know, in your head, you can be having this conversation with yourself. The amygdala is a wonderful thing that is there to help to protect you. At the same time, it's not really good with nuance. Or reality, actually. And it doesn't tell the difference between reality and, you know, past experiences or what you're seeing on television very well. And so all of your experiences that you've had before, because the brain stores all of that, stores everything. And that's why it's really important to guard well what you see. But all of that can come to bear in a moment of trauma where, you know, the amygdala kicks in and sends out all of those, you know, stress hormones and so forth. And so all of your experience, like you said, your body now knows what it's like to come near death, which mm-hmm. is a, you know, a primal, a source of really primal fear. And so 12 years, you know, over a span of 12 years, you're still working through it. And I think that's another thing that is really helpful for folks who are listening to understand is that while everybody is different, generally speaking, this is not an overnight process. It can be a lifelong process for many people. And so being patient with oneself, being kind, being accommodating, it can be also really important in terms of, you know, the way I've styled it is, you know, breaking up with trauma and breaking up with, you know, emotional violence so that it doesn't control one. It's really important to take that power. Speaking of which, I'm curious about your experience. And if you, you know, let me know if you're willing to talk about this, but what it was to actually come face to face with this man in the courtroom. Most of the time, I think folks are, you know, they're required because, as you said at the very beginning of the show, defendants have quite a number of rights, and to face their accusers is one of those rights. And so I imagine that you have to be in the courtroom with him, and when you're in the on the witness stand, he's there in your line of sight. You know, what was like, that like for you?
For me, I was never able to identify him by face. It was so dark that night, and I think he may have made some physical maneuvers to shield me from looking directly at him in the dark. So for me, it was the very first time I was face to face with him was at a pretrial hearing, and I was wondering what it was going to be like. And I remember I kind of stared him down, and we were both standing in front of the judge. We had a huge line of people between us, you know, all of the attorneys and court security were standing between us, but I sort of looked in front of the line so that I could look at him, and I just stared at him. And he looked back, and it was such an experience like you would have at a grocery store. It was funny how commonplace it was, but he looked back at me and then glanced away and then realized I was staring at him. And he looked at me again, like, that's an odd social behavior to be staring at me. And then he looked away kind of embarrassed. And then I was a little embarrassed for staring at him. And so I had wondered if I was going to be empowered or if I was going to be terrified, and neither of those things happened. It was just a really benign sort of saline social experience. But then after I testified, I think I was through the whole court process, I was more afraid of his attorney than I was of him. Just because you know, his attorney was also very kind and very warm and inviting. And I just felt like I was being set in, you know, having some trap laid the entire time.
Yeah.
But as far as he went in my, and this is how different this experience was than most people's, the prosecutors didn't even ask if I could identify him in court because I would have had to say no. The only way I could identify him was, you know, that whoever ejaculated on me that night is the person who did this. And that was the only way I could identify him. So I didn't have, even when I saw his picture in the paper a few years before the trial. I think when he fled, the country is when I first saw a picture of him. And I didn't really have much of an emotional reaction to that at all. I do know that other people noticed, and I did this on purpose, but every time I testified either to the facts of what happened or when I testified at sentencings, I stared him down as I walked past him because he took away all of my freedom and all of my power and all of my humanity for about 20 minutes. I have no idea how long the assault lasted, but I'm going to say for about 20 minutes. He stripped me of all of that. And I really wanted him to see me walking around free. And to know, you know, he wasn't in handcuffs or anything in that courtroom, but, and there's a reason for that, so that the jury isn't biased against him. But I knew that there were a couple armed guards near him who were making sure he wasn't going anywhere, and that there were handcuffs waiting right out courtroom for him to put on. And I really wanted him to see me have freedom, and to see him not having freedom. You know, I try not to be vindictive or angry, or I hope he gets it. It's actually pretty upsetting to me when people say, well, you know, rapists get raped a lot in jail, so he's probably getting raped in jail. That's a little upsetting to me, just because I don't like to think about people getting raped, you know, anybody. But I do like, for better or worse, maybe it doesn't make me the most enlightened person, but I do like knowing that, that he's not going to experience having his whole freedom again for the rest of his life. I hope he has a basic human right. You know, I hope that he's getting the amount of nutrients he needs. I hope that he's has access to medical care. I hope that, you know, I certainly don't want, you know, the prison system to abuse anybody or hurt anybody, but I do like that, that he's going to have this experience of not having all of his freedom for the rest of his life. I find joy in that, and I'm not extremely proud of that, but it's a fact. And so that was my big experience seeing him, was getting to have those roles reversed was something I really enjoyed.
Well, you know, and it's a profound thing that you've said there, that, you know, for that period of time, he made a choice and divested you of your humanity and of your autonomy and self-determination, which are such basic elemental needs for human beings. You know, you're not human without those things, really.
Right.
And then, you know, of course, one of the things that I hear a lot from people who come and talk to me in my own work about having survived sexual assault, particularly when it's somebody with whom they actually had a relationship, is that they are concerned about whether they are being vindictive and whether they're becoming more like that person. You know, am I a good person because I am glad that they're facing consequences for what they did? And one of the things that, that might be useful to consider is that the universe requires balance. And so this is an opportunity for balance. It's sort of a balancing act, that what he did to you is really not just 20 minutes, but it has continued. And in a way, you know, I hesitate to say that it's a life sentence because, you know, the whole point of having the show was saying, you know, it's about breaking up with all of that, but it's a life process. It can be a life process.
Yeah.
And, It doesn't preclude one from leading a healthy and happy life. But, you know, this experience is going to be with you always for as long as you're alive. And so that experience is going to be with him as well for as long as he's alive. So I don't know that I see it as being necessarily vindictive or, you know, taking joy in the suffering of another person, but it is understanding balance. And that balance is an essential way that the universe functions. So perhaps
that
it can be helpful.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah,
that's actually really beautiful, and it was really helpful for me to hear that. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm again not even sure whether this is recording at all, and if it hasn't, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to come back.
Okay.
And make this a two-parter. And I'm finding myself doing that a lot, actually. I'm going to have to reconsider whether I need to keep it to an hour and maybe make it an hour and a half or something like that. But I think I'd like to make this a two-parter because there is so much more I know that you have to say that can be so helpful to folks who are finding them in a situation where they are, you know, managing the aftermath of trauma and the impact that it can have on a person at the very most basic level of who they are.
I would love that. And I would be great. I would be really happy to come back.
Wonderful. That's great. Okay, so we're going to work that out and make sure that you come back. Amarina, thank you so, so very much for coming on and for being so transparent. I hope that your willingness to be so open and frank, you know, and uninhibited about this encourages other folks to do that and experience the empowerment that comes from it. I'm thankful for everyone who is listening. I want to say especially thank you to the folks who are listening from around the world. I have folks listening in Algeria, in Argentina, Germany. I saw somebody listening from North Korea. No, I'm sorry, not North Korea. It could be nice if we were able to reach out to folks across that border, but it was in South Korea, actually. And so I'm excited to know that there are people around the world who are also listening in, and I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Facebook at Untangled Resolutions, and I'm happy to hear from folks and to hear about what topics they want to hear about. But we're going to be back again with another episode soon, so look out for that. And thanks for listening. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.